Hello, friend. Happy New Year's. Thank you, as always, for listening to The Tully Show. Your New Year's resolutions are not going to happen. You are not going to lose that weight, and probably neither am I. You are not going to build an ark or whatever other insane thing you resolve to do while inebriated a late night on December 31st. You know what you can make good on? A resolution to listen to me blabber about everything we talk about here on The Tully Show and more at great length several times a week, exclusively at patreon.com/MikeTully. The water's fine. Come on and join us. patreon.com/MikeTully. Hope to see you there.
Okay, you ready to start this show? Your host of the evening is a really funny dude. I forgot his last name, but I've seen him before, and he's really funny. Give it up for Mike.
Coming to you live on tape from an above-ground basement in rapidly gentrifying Culver City adjacent California, boasting a partially obstructed view of the world-famous Hollywood sign. This is The Tully Show. I am your host, Mike Tully. Joining me today, a professor at the University of North Florida and author of a book entitled One Person, One Vote, A Surprising History of Gerrymandering in America. Hello and welcome, Nick Seabrook.
Hey, Mike. It's great to be here.
Nick, this is your second book on the titillating subject of gerrymandering. Why does this lane appeal to you so greatly, and what compelled you to not only visit but revisit it in book-length form?
So as a political scientist and as an immigrant, I've always kind of been drawn, I think, to those parts of the U.S. political system that are just kind of weird and crazy and unique when you look at other countries around the world. And I remember when I was back in grad school studying for my PhD around 2005, and I heard about this insane thing called gerrymandering, this idea that the politicians who were going to be running for re-election in districts across the country are also the ones who get to draw those districts, who get to decide who the voters will be, who will then determine whether they get to continue in office. And I immediately thought that that sounded entirely insane, and I wanted to learn more about it and how the wealthiest, most powerful democratic nation in the world could have this situation where the politicians get to choose their voters rather than the voters getting to choose their politicians.
Yeah, that sentence is also in the book, and it really does cut to the very heart. I think you quoted somebody as having said that. This is not a phenomenon that has recently been noted as being strange. For as long as there's been gerrymandering, there have been critics of gerrymandering. I didn't realize that you were not from America. Where are you from?
I grew up in the UK, so I was born in England. And England, the UK, is one of those nations that has figured out over time that this is really not a good idea and that we need to do something about it. And part of why I wrote the book was to draw attention to this issue and hopefully get us to a point where we can have sort of free and fair elections. We can take our thumbs off the scale and just let the people decide who wants to be in office and kind of let the chips fall where they may.
Nick, can we really trust the people?
So I'm an optimist when it comes to this question. I'm a small D Democrat.
Yeah.
The people cannot necessarily always be trusted to make the best choices
yeah.
and the best decisions for themselves. But I think that situation is infinitely preferable than a situation where the powerful, the wealthy, those who have kind of those positions within our society are dictating those choices for us. So
sure.
For better, for worse, I think having that power reside with the people rather than the politicians is preferable, whatever that may lead us to.
You know, I'm reminded of a quote, I forget from who, this classic golden age of Hollywood movie director said of the audience. I'm paraphrasing, individually, they're a bunch of idiots, but collectively, they're a genius.
Yeah, and something similar, a similar sentiment often comes up in political science, this idea that voters are individually irrational, but collectively are just about rational enough to at least figure out that when the people in power are doing things that they don't like, they can throw the bums out and replace them with new politicians who hopefully will do things a little bit better. And at the very least, a democracy will function when the people have the ability to remove those in power and replace them with someone else. And one of the biggest harms of gerrymandering that I talk about in the book is that it kind of short circuits that mechanism. It allows politicians who are in power to insulate themselves against the will of the people and to prevent their own removal.
So you mentioned that the UK, like I guess every other representative democracy, has gerrymandering is an ill which may be germane to the democratic system, but other democracies have recognized that ill, the weed that naturally grows from it, and addressed it. I guess I had assumed, I'd never thought about it, that it was just something representative democracies all had to deal with. You say in the book that's it is a uniquely American phenomenon. How have other nations dealt with it? Why has America not taken similar steps to address it here?
So the way I think that pretty much every other nation that uses districts for their elections has arrived at the conclusion that something needs to be done about gerrymandering is simply by recognizing the fundamental conflict of interest that it creates. That when you allow politicians, the people in government, to draw their own districts, it's perfectly natural for them to want to draw districts that will allow them to keep their seats, that will allow their political party to stay in power. And the incentives are just fundamentally wrong in that calculus. And so, what other countries have realized is that you don't need to make wholesale changes to the system to address that. You simply need to alter those incentives. And fundamentally, fixing gerrymandering just means that you have to have someone else accomplish this task. You have to have someone other than incumbent politicians draw the districts that those politicians will run in. And you're not always going to get a perfectly fair system. Every electoral system that uses districts has some inequality, has some bias built into those districts. They may favor urban voters or rural voters or certain groups within society. But when you take those thumbs off of the scale and you have a process where the people who are drawing the districts are not the people who will be running for those same seats, you get better outcomes across the board. And I think the reason why the US has found it so difficult to fix the problem of gerrymandering has to do with our decentralized federal system. So, pretty much everywhere else, redistricting, the drawing of districts, is something that is done at the national level. And so, in the UK, you have the districts for the House of Commons, the elected component of Parliament, that are drawn at the national level. And so to fix gerrymandering, all they did was create an entirely independent commission that was insulated from the elected politicians, and they just let them go about their business and get on with things. But here in the US, redistricting is something that is done at the state level. Each of the 50 individual states has responsibility for drawing the districts for their state elections and for their seats in the House of Representatives. And so there's really no easy national solution that can be implemented. It's something that you have to kind of fight at the state level every decade after we get a new census and the districts have to be redrawn again.
So let's lay out sort of the history and the nature of the issue a bit, and then at the end we'll talk about the ways in which we might solve it and the extent to which we are having any success in attempting to do so. First of all, I just feel compelled to make sure everybody knows what we're talking about. The frequently cited definition that you cite in the book from a University of Chicago PhD student, Elmer Griffith, districts would not seem to be gerrymandered unless they were established especially for election purposes and were formed intentionally in a particular manner for partisan advantage. You carve up land masses and neighborhoods in unnatural ways because you think you can game the vote by apportioning where the Democrats and the Republicans are most likely to live. The name of the book, the title of the book, One Person, One Vote, which is obviously somewhat tongue-in-cheek. That's the intent of how our voting system is supposed to work, and we all know it gets subverted in all sorts of different ways. If you bring that phrase up to me, before I even think of gerrymandering, I probably think of like five other ways in which I might say that my vote is worth less than other Americans' votes. I live in California, and for starters, there's, you know, we don't elect presidents based on the popular vote. And I've seen defenses for using the Electoral College, which you may or may not let me just ask you that. Do you think the system of using the Electoral College is preferable to directly electing? Because the case that people make is you could just pretty much win California, Texas, and New York, and you could let the rest of the nation starve to death, and you could just continue winning like that forever. So we sort of have to give some... We do have to put our thumb on the scale ever so slightly for the flyover states. Do you accept that argument?
So it's interesting you bring up the Electoral College, because that's another one of these kind of weird and quirky and unique features of the U.S. political system. And I've kind of experienced the Electoral College from both ends, having lived initially in New York. And presidential elections in New York are kind of similar to California. The Democrat is always going to win, and so the candidates never pay any attention to New York. And then I moved to Florida, one of the kind of, at least recently, one of the key swing states, and the experience was entirely different. Every time you turn on your TV in Florida during a presidential election campaign, pretty much the entire commercial break is just advertisements for Republican candidate, the Democratic candidate, kind of back and forth. And here in Jacksonville, we've in recent campaigns had visits and campaign events from all of the candidates running. Obama's been here, Hillary Clinton was here, Donald Trump has been here. And so this is one of the issues that the Electoral College creates, is that the presidential election is basically decided in a few key swing states. And that's where the candidates pour the overwhelming majority of their resources in terms of campaigning and in terms of money. I have similar problems with the Electoral College that I do with gerrymandering. And I think by and large, these types of barriers to democracy are better dismantled. Similarly to gerrymandering, the Electoral College is something that's incredibly difficult to fix for different reasons, because it's in the Constitution, and amending the Constitution is so incredibly challenging as well. But because, as I said, I'm a small D Democrat, I tend to believe that allowing the people to make the choices is going to be better than putting barriers in their way. I tend to reach a similar conclusion about the Electoral College, that it would be better off done away with, and that a popular vote for president where everyone's voice counts equally is a better approach to than the one that we're doing right now.
I see. So I kind of got sidetracked in the initial question that I was driving toward, which is, we're kind of getting a little mixed up. We're talking about elections at a state level and elections at the national level. But as a voter, in the spirit of the one person, one vote ideal, compared to the popular vote versus the Electoral College, compared to the fact that in California, I have two senators and so does the state of Wyoming, and I probably have as many people living within a mile of me as live in the entire state of Wyoming, how much unfairness would you guess gerrymandering introduces into the system compared to the other ills, which conceivably subvert the one person, one vote ideal? How big a problem is it, relatively speaking?
I think it's not just a big problem, but it's a problem that has gotten worse in recent years because of the technology and the data that are now available to people who draw districts. Not just having this incredibly granular census data and other data on people's political preferences, where you can kind of pinpoint where Democrats live, where Republicans live, and sort of carve them up and move them around between districts to achieve some kind of political outcome. And that really hasn't been the case. Gerrymandering has become such an influence in Wisconsin that there's really not a meaningful opportunity for the party that is currently in power in that state, the Republican Party, to ever really lose its majority. And it's reached the point in Wisconsin where the GOP can lose the popular vote and still win close to two-thirds of the seats in the state legislature. And so those are the examples that I highlight in the book as being the real harm of gerrymandering, where a political party can effectively and entirely insulate itself from ever being thrown out of office. And that has really significant implications for how the state is governed, that they don't have to pay attention all that much to public opinion. They don't have to worry about whether the policies that they're putting in place are especially popular. And this kind of gerrymandering, where it's not just putting the thumb on the scale for one election or a couple of elections, but effectively turning a state no longer into a democracy decade after decade, is the harm that is becoming much more prevalent today, and which really hasn't been the case if you look historically at the kind of gerrymandering that's happened in the U.S. throughout our history.
I want to talk about 2010 is where the sea change comes. You say so in the book, and I think it's a generally agreed upon fact. First of all, the origin story of gerrymandering, which is not the origin of gerrymandering, just really the term. Turns out we've all been saying it wrong this entire time. This is a thorough history of gerrymandering in the U.S. beyond just being interesting history to read. What does the history, you think, what does it teach us? What does it demonstrate? What does it tell us about our present and future?
Right. So the kind of the common myth about the origin of gerrymandering is that it was invented in 1812 in Massachusetts, that it was the creation of the governor of the state at the time, Elbridge Gerry, and that he is the person for whom the practice of gerrymandering is named. And it turns out that basically every component of that story, once you actually examine the historical evidence, is either wrong or misleading. That gerrymandering had been going on in the United States for close to 100 years before we had a word with which to describe it. Secondly, Elbridge Gerry was not responsible for this original quote-unquote gerrymander, which kind of spawned his infamy and which led to the creation of this term. And then thirdly, his name wasn't Elbridge Gerry, it was Elbridge Gerry with a hard G. And for many decades after, gerrymandering was actually pronounced gerrymandering. And it was not until around about the mid-19th century that the pronunciation started to evolve into the more natural gerrymander that we talk about today. So one of the things that I wanted to try and do in the book is to kind of rehabilitate Elbridge Gerry's historical legacy, at least to some extent, because this is basically the one thing that he's remembered for today. It was something that he didn't in fact even do. And he later went on to serve as vice president under James Madison. He was a delegate at the Constitutional Convention. This is a hugely important figure in U.S. history. He's someone who if he had been a younger man, would probably have been elected president in his own right at some point. But unfortunately, he passed away while he was serving as James Madison's vice president. So the first thing I do in the book is to kind of go back and say, well, what is the true origin story of gerrymandering? And it turns out it goes back all the way before the Constitution, all the way before independence, and that gerrymandering was happening during the colonial era. So I think readers will learn a few things about not just the history of gerrymandering and its origin from the book, but also just how fundamentally this practice has touched the lives and careers of some of our most famous and influential politicians, people like James Madison, Abraham Lincoln, and others who achieved great things in their own right, but whose career trajectories were fundamentally altered and influenced by this practice of gerrymandering.
Incredibly dumb question. Is gerrymandering all bad? Are there any positives that have ever or could ever come out of it? I'm all about, you know, unintended consequences. I don't know. Is it a mixed bag in any way at all, or is it pure absolute evil?
Gerrymandering has occasionally been used to achieve what I think most people would consider to be positive ends. And in particular, a kind of gerrymandering was fairly frequently employed in the wake of the civil rights movement to try and ensure that now that the kind of explicit disenfranchisement and segregation and a lot of the policies that we saw in the Jim Crow South and elsewhere, now that those have been declared illegal, how can we make sure that groups that had previously been discriminated against get fair representation in government? And one of the things that the Voting Rights Act of 1965 did was to require states, if those states had large enough and sufficiently geographically distinct racial and language minority populations, it required states to draw districts that would allow those populations to elect representatives of their choice, to have a voice in government. And so for a number of decades now, that kind of gerrymandering, which fits within the definition that I use in the book, you're drawing the districts specifically to increase the likelihood of some kind of political result. But there, the result is to kind of remedy the effects of past discrimination and to allow a group that maybe hasn't had a voice in politics to have one and to get representation in the legislature. That's probably about the only example that I can think of, because generally gerrymandering is employed for nefarious purposes rather than positive ones.
Right, but like practically speaking, what you're saying is if you draw up districts so that there's five districts that are 30% black, you might never see a black representative come out of it. If you make two districts that are 80% black, there's a very good chance that in the hallowed halls of Congress there will actually be African Americans, and that you'll be represented not only by voting but by it being able to put people from their community in the halls of power. So let's talk about the 2010 redistricting. I was not familiar with the, it's like a Marvel kind of acronym, REDMAP, REDMAP. What does that stand for, if you know off the top of your head? What is it? How is it used, and how is it a game changer?
So REDMAP stands for the Redistricting Majority Project. And this was a creation of the Republican Party. And it was an effort to try and reverse what had at that point been several decades in which Democrats were the ones who were doing the majority of the gerrymandering. And so 2010 is really the transition point when gerrymandering went from being something that was primarily done by Democrats, because Democrats tended to control the majority of states and state governments in the 1970s and the 1980s, and even into the 1990s as well. But what the GOP figured out is that if they could do better in state elections, particularly take advantage of the opportunity of the 2010 midterms, where you had an unpopular Democratic president in the form of Barack Obama. His approval ratings were underwater at the time. And you had a census going on, which meant that whoever won that election would then get to redraw the districts in their state once the census had taken place. And so what the GOP did in 2010 was to funnel money into state legislative races, particularly in swing states like Wisconsin, North Carolina, Florida, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, states where they would be able to benefit the most from gerrymandering. Because if you are already the large majority in the state, if you already are winning elections by large margins, Democrats in California, New York, Republicans in the redder states, there's not all that much you can gain from gerrymandering. You can use it to maybe increase your seats at the margins. You can use it to shore up the seats that you already hold. But it's in swing states where gerrymandering provides the greatest opportunities. And that was what the Republicans figured out. And so they used this campaign effort. They used their fundraising and their targeting in the 2010 election to take control of state government in all of these swing states. And then they had a coordinated redistricting effort once the census results came out to draw the districts in those states in a way that would allow them to sustain and build on that control in subsequent elections. And it's notable that in the states that were the red map focused states, the Republican Party basically held on to the control of the legislatures of those states for the entire decade after 2010, that they were able to gerrymander effectively enough that even though they maybe lost the popular vote here or there, they were able to hold on to their majorities in all of those states. And what that meant is that in a lot of places, they then got to draw the districts again after the 2020 census. And this was really the first time we saw a nationally coordinated redistricting effort with the goal of leveraging gerrymandering to retain control of state governments and to draw districts for Congress in a way that would give them the edge at the national level as well.
So 2020, there's a census every 10 years on the zero year, and that's when the redistricting happens. 2020 was an opportunity to address and perhaps fix the ills of the previous redistricting. I gather from what you're saying that things did not get better, and I gather from the book that they actually got worse. A couple of quotes: it's only likely to get worse looking at the latest cycle emerging from redistricting. Another quote: the number of competitive seats has been declining every decade and is now at its lowest point in probably 100 years. Sounds like we're moving in the wrong direction.
I would say that there is both cause for concern and at least some cause for optimism. The decline in competitive seats, and by competitive, I simply mean a district where there's at least a plausible chance that either a Democratic candidate or a Republican candidate could win the seat. And gerrymandering doesn't like competitive seats because competitive seats introduce uncertainty. They introduce situations where you can have major swings between one political party or the other. And so the way that gerrymandering generally works is to reduce the number of competitive seats and to draw enough safe seats for the party in power that they don't have to worry about losing control. That is certainly a concerning trend, and it's one that has been moving in the wrong direction for some time now. Where I think that there's at least some cause for optimism is that pretty much any time the people have been given the opportunity to weigh in on the question of gerrymandering. And you've seen this out in California with the creation of the California Citizens Redistricting Commission. So California is one of the states where an independent and in California, a commission made up of regular citizens, made up of registered voters, randomly selected, evenly balanced between Democrats, Republicans, and independents. And there are several other states where we've seen similar efforts be successful. So for instance, Michigan, I think, is the biggest success story of the redistricting and gerrymandering reform movement, because just like in California, the voters in Michigan voted in an amendment to the state constitution that created a citizens redistricting commission. And what we saw is that Michigan, one of the red map states, one of the states that Republicans had gerrymandered heavily a decade ago, Michigan now has some of the fairest maps in the country. And democracy in Michigan looks pretty healthy moving forward. So the cause for optimism, I think, is that every time the people have the opportunity to vote for these things, they vote for reform, they vote to get rid of gerrymandering. The problem is getting them the opportunity to have a voice, because gerrymandering fundamentally operates by preventing the people from having an effective voice in government. It really is dependent on groups collecting signatures, getting initiatives on the ballot, lobbying representatives to at least allow for more meaningful public input. But I'm optimistic, at least based on the fact that there seems to be broad support for ending gerrymandering. It's just a case of allowing people to have that input.
As you say in the book, everybody wants to get rid of gerrymandering when they're the minority party, but nobody wants to get rid of it when they're winning. And the problem is, yes, why would the party who's currently in power give the people the power to take away their ability to retain their own jobs, despite the fact that they full know that in all likelihood, 5 years from now, I'm going to be the minority party and it would work great for me. It's just sort of like if everybody could just hold their breath and take their lumps for one or two election cycles, we could kind of fix the whole thing. But long-term thinking is not a feature of an elected democracy with relatively short terms. In the elections, the local elections, say congressional elections, and I guess even Senate elections, where it is a foregone conclusion that a Republican or a Democrat is going to win, the primary effectively becomes the election. And it's, a politics 101. If you're a Democrat, you run to the left in the primary and then run back to the center for the general election, and vice versa for a Republican. You don't do that when you know that you're going to win the election. If you're running in a red state, you run to the right and then you stay to the right. This is where the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world come from, right? To what extent? So you think about, well, this is an issue. If I live in, the northwest of Michigan, it affects me if my district is gerrymandered, but it affects all of us if there are incredibly polarizing figures making it to the national stage, and gerrymandering is contributing to their ability to get to the national stage and remain just as polarizing when they're there, because they know the only price that they'll ever have to pay from voters in the next election cycle is if somebody even more extreme than them comes along, right? Can you talk about the extent to which gerrymandering might be contributing to the health of our overall national political dialogue?
Yeah, and so Georgia is actually a good example of this. Georgia is a state that obviously has become really competitive at the national level. Joe Biden won Georgia narrowly in 2020 after it had voted for Republicans in prior elections. And we've had all of these really, really close Senate elections and runoffs in Georgia. But Georgia is also a state where Republicans have controlled redistricting for the last two decades, and where they have used that control to make Georgia's elections for Congress and for the state legislature significantly less competitive. And districts like Marjorie Taylor Greene's district are an illustration of this. She represents a seat in kind of rural North Georgia, north of Atlanta, where the district has been drawn so there is basically no opportunity for Democrats to ever win. And we've seen this in recent elections. She's had Democratic challengers who have raised massive amounts of money and have ended up losing by huge margins because Marjorie Taylor Greene knows that to keep her seat, all she needs to do is to win the Republican primary in her district. And going back to this this point about gerrymandering, reducing the overall competitiveness of seats, this has gone hand in hand with the trend of politicians becoming more ideologically extreme, with the disappearance of the middle in American government, that Democrats are now overwhelmingly left-wing, Republicans are now overwhelmingly right-wing. And gerrymandering reinforces that because it creates this situation where the primary election is the decisive election in more and more districts. And the way to win primary elections is not to be a moderate. The way to win primary elections is to appeal to the base. And so these trends have kind of gone with one another. They have reinforced one another. And it's something that gerrymandering is going to continue to exacerbate. And I think we're likely to see more and more of these extreme kind of politicians on both the left and the right not only win, but hold on to those seats because they know that if they win their primary, they're sticking around in office.
So change or improvement, it seems to me, can only come from some combination of, I guess, about four sources. Elected officials themselves can improve or fix the system. The judiciary can address it and is often asked to. Voters can change the system, and perhaps a change in the system that we use for voting. Can you talk about where, well, first of all, can you explain, I know it's been explained to me before, but I'm still not really clear on exactly how ranked choice voting works. It seems like a partial antidote to, takes a lot of the power away from gerrymandering. How might it help? And they recently used ranked choice voting in an election in Alaska, right? Which Sarah Palin lost.
Yep.
How, I feel like that's one of these things that the internet considers a no-brainer that we all know in the real world would probably never actually happen. If you told me a state was going to experiment with ranked choice voting, I would have expected it would have been like in Oregon. How in Alaska, of all places, did they even come to use it? And did it have the sort of result that proponents of ranked choice voting would have predicted it would?
So ranked choice voting has tended to come about through a similar mechanism as changes to get rid of gerrymandering, in that the people have been given an opportunity to vote on reform. It's the kind of thing that the politicians in power who are risk averse, who tend not to want to make major changes to the mechanisms of democracy, have tended to be resistant to. But when the people are given the opportunity to vote on it, they tend to recognize that it is, by and large, fundamentally fairer than our kind of regular first past the post, whichever candidate gets more votes, even if they don't get a majority, they end up winning the seat. And ranked choice voting, to kind of return to the example that I was talking about of Georgia, kind of combines the original election and the runoff election into a single ballot. So the way things work in Georgia and that we've seen in these recent Senate elections is that if no candidate wins an overall majority on election day, You then hold a second election a month or 2 months later between the top two candidates, and whoever wins that gets elected. Ranked choice voting, or instant runoff voting, as it's sometimes called, and there are different variations of how it works, kind of combines that into a single ballot. So you have the opportunity to vote both in the kind of first stage and the second stage at the same time. You will rank the candidates on the ballot according to your preference. And if no one gets an overall majority, you can then eliminate the candidate who finished last and then redistribute their votes to the second choice in terms of people who had marked their ballot. And there are a few good things about ranked choice voting. It allows moderate candidates to be more successful. So if you look at a state like Alaska, most elections in Alaska, even if you nominate a moderate Democrat, because Alaska is a Republican state, that candidate is unlikely to win. But what we saw in the recent Alaska election is the Democrats nominated a moderate, and the Republicans had a couple of candidates, one of them Sarah Palin, who were considered more ideologically extreme. And so it gave an opportunity for voters in the middle to give their kind of second choice votes to someone who maybe is from the other side of the aisle, but they're the kind of moderate Democrat that a Republican voter might prefer. And it seems to be something that is catching on. Alaska has it. Maine has ranked choice voting as well, and it's something that's being pushed for in other states too. And I think it's generally a good thing. I think that it, at least to some extent, pushes back against the phenomenon that I was talking about a minute ago, that we're seeing extremist candidates advancing from the primary elections, and then there's no opportunity for them to lose the general. Ranked choice voting tends, in some circumstances, to allow moderate candidates with cross-party appeal to have a greater chance of winning than they would have under a regular electoral system.
I think it also allows people to express their true political beliefs a little bit more in a way that is healthy and needed in a two-party system. You know, the classic example would be, well, I would love for a libertarian to win, but I couldn't stand for the Democrat to win, therefore I'm voting for Herschel Walker, which is nobody's idea of a good candidate in a system where you say, if the Republicans had woken up the morning after Election Day and had seen that 30% of Republican-leaning people voted for a Libertarian and all put Herschel Walker second, that would be a very, very, very clear sign to them for the next time around. Your people are, they lean very hard Republican, but there's a certain brand of Republicanism that they want that the Republican Party isn't giving them. And it might well, that in and of itself could have a moderating influence on the sorts of candidates that get pushed by the parties to be the standard bearers. I mean, we're not doing away with the two-party system anytime soon. That would at least, I think, put a little bit of a moderating effect on the way that they operate. Because at this point, they sort of know that you're in... They have their bases in a take it or leave it position, correct?
Yeah. So if you're someone who is inclined towards the Libertarian Party or is inclined towards the Green Party, you face a tough choice in most elections. You can either cast your vote in a way that's actually going to have an impact, which means that you have to abandon your party of choice and pick between the Democrat or the Republican and hold your nose and vote for one of them, or you're basically wasting your vote because in a two-party system, votes for third-party candidates, votes for independents generally are not going to be consequential. But ranked choice voting allows you to have it both ways. You can vote your conscience, you can rank the Libertarian or the Green Party candidate first on your ballot, and know that you're not wasting your vote, that you can then rank the other candidates according to your preferences and once the Libertarian or the Green Party candidate gets eliminated, your vote is going to count equally for the final determination between the Democrat and the Republican. And if you're someone for whom being a Libertarian and not having the opportunity, other than, as I said, holding your nose and voting for a Democrat or a Republican to have influence, maybe this is the kind of thing that re-engages you a little bit more with politics. If you're a moderate and you really, really dislike both Democrats and Republicans, it gives you an opportunity to express yourself more fully at the ballot box when in other circumstances your distaste for the two-party system might lead you just to stay at home and not vote at all.
Back to gerrymandering and tax we might take to sort to try to address it, the judiciary. Theoretically, we would expect judges to throw out egregiously gerrymandered voting districts. How often in practice has that happened? I'm kind of curious on what legal basis, when that happens, does that happen? And how sufficient a safeguard in practice has the judiciary proven to be against gerrymandering to our present date?
So the answer, and lawsuits have for many, many decades now been probably the primary way that people have gone about trying to deal with the problem of gerrymandering. And at least at the federal level, at the Supreme Court level, those lawsuits have been very unsuccessful. The first Supreme Court decision about partisan gerrymandering was in 1986, and at no point have litigants been able to convince a majority of the Supreme Court that gerrymandering is something that needs to be addressed as a constitutional question. And the argument that has been made is that gerrymandering is a form of equal protection violation under the 14th Amendment, that by discriminating against voters based on their partisanship, that gerrymandering violates the Equal Protection Clause. And that has largely been an uphill battle because there's not a whole lot of strong precedent applying those sorts of equal protection arguments to discrimination based on political party. There's a rich history of equal protection law and precedent, but there is much less in terms of people bringing successful lawsuits based on discrimination against them because they were a Democrat or because they were a Republican. And so what has happened, particularly in the last few years, because in 2019, the Supreme Court, in a case called Rucho versus Common Cause, basically decided that it was done with this entire enterprise and said, you can no longer bring lawsuits in federal court challenging gerrymandering as a violation of equal protection. And so things have largely shifted to the state courts with what I would say is a mixed record of success. So there have been successful lawsuits based on state constitutional protections of things like free elections or fair elections or open elections. States tend to have a variety of provisions in their constitutions designed to ensure that elections are done in a way that is fair and free and without significant discrimination. And those lawsuits have been successful. For instance, we saw in New York, where the Democrats attempted to gerrymander after the 2020 census, the courts in that state struck it down and they said, go back to the drawing board, draw the districts in a way that is not biased towards Democrats. We saw it too in places like North Carolina and Pennsylvania, where state courts have said, this time to Republicans, you drew the districts in a way that was unfair, that violates the state constitution, go back and redraw them, or we're going to impose a map ourselves. The problem with this strategy is that, firstly, it's expensive. It takes a lot of resources to litigate these types of cases. And secondly, it takes a long time. Courts tend to move slowly, and things when it comes to redistricting tend to be time sensitive. Elections are going to happen when they're going to happen, and courts are not generally equipped to deal with these large and complex lawsuits in a way that gets things resolved in time for those elections to be held. So here in Florida, for instance, we have a lawsuit that's challenging Governor Ron DeSantis's gerrymander of our congressional districts that led to the overwhelming majority of Florida's representatives in Congress being Republicans. And that case is currently dragging out before the Florida Supreme Court. They sent it back down to the lower courts. It's probably going to take several years for us to find out if the districts that were used a month ago in Florida to elect members of Congress are in fact a violation of our state constitution, which a lot of people, including myself, believe that they were. And then there's the problem that there's no guarantee that you're actually going to win these cases, no matter how egregious the underlying gerrymander is. So there have been examples of states like Kansas, for instance, where we've gone through this entire process, and at the end, the state Supreme Court says, no, we're not going to do anything. We're just going to leave the gerrymander in place.
Are you saying the judicial branch is politicized?
I am saying that.
Okay.
I don't think that will come as any surprise that just as we've seen with Supreme Court justices, Republican presidents tend to appoint justices who end up deciding cases in a way that benefits Republicans and vice versa for Democrats. And at the state level, at least in states where governors get to appoint judges, something similar happens. In other states, state judges will be elected. And so often they will make explicitly partisan appeals to their voters in order to win. In just a few months, there's going to be a hugely important election for the Wisconsin Supreme Court, where you will have a justice running as a Democrat against a candidate running as a Republican. And that election will determine whether Republicans or Democrats have a majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So throughout the history, it's been impossible to kind of disentangle politics from kind of neutral application of law and of constitutional principles. And that's the case in gerrymandering as well. I think generally, judges do a somewhat better job of being fair when it comes to the drawing of districts than politicians do. But that's not exactly a particularly high bar. And there are plenty of examples of judges in this context making decisions in a way that appears to be political.
All of this having been said, I guess this is the last question I'll ask you. Do you generally feel, however slowly, however haphazardly, that in regard to the issue of gerrymandering, we are moving in the right direction in a meaningful enough way that we might actually see a change in our lifetime and the overall health of our political system and discourse?
I think that we are certainly moving in the right direction. But we are moving incredibly slowly. And part of the problem is that gerrymandering is basically something that happens once a decade. And everyone pays attention to it while it's happening. And then almost immediately people forget about it. They're focused on whatever election or whatever campaign is happening right now. Who's running for president? Is Trump going to run again? Is Biden going to run again? Other things draw our attention, and we forget about the fact that the fundamental rules of the game have been rigged one way or the other in a lot of states. That being said, the reason why I have at least some optimism is that we've seen improvements in a number of states. California, Michigan, that I mentioned before, Colorado now has a new citizens redistricting commission. We've seen some progress in places like New York, even here in Florida. Although part of the problem is that when you put something in the state constitution, which says that you're not allowed to gerrymander, and then the legislature and the governor go ahead and gerrymander anyway, and the state Supreme Court is packed with their cronies who won't do anything about it, that's a challenging situation. It's why I say that the way to deal with this is not to try and constrain the people. I use the metaphor in the book of the foxes that are guarding the hen houses. And any situation where you leave the foxes in charge, it's going to be very difficult to prevent them from eating the chickens. The way to fix this is to take the foxes out of the equation, have someone else guard the hen house. And that's why I think the use of these redistricting commissions is the way forward. I'm also encouraged because for the first time in the first time that I can remember, Congress is actually paying attention to this as well. So since Joe Biden took office, we have seen two bills come up before the House and the Senate. Neither of them has gotten past the filibuster. But there have been two federal bills being debated that would fix gerrymandering when it comes to national elections. So that is encouraging as well. I'm less encouraged by the pace of progress, but I am at least encouraged that things are belatedly and slowly moving in the right direction.
I talked to a lot of people who've written a lot of nonfiction books about a lot of doom and gloom scenarios, you know, climate change, what have you. That's about the most, one of the more positive notes I've been able to leave off on in talking about these subjects that influence all of our presence and future. So I'll take it. I'll take it. My guest has been Nick Seabrook, the author of a book entitled One Person, One Vote, A Surprising History of Gerrymandering in America. Thank you so much, Nick.
Thanks, Mike.